Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Siobhan Harnett and Tim Heath. Siobhan's the viticulturalist at Cloudy Bay, and Tim is the winemaker. How are you guys?
Very well, thanks.
Very good, thanks.
What we're going to do is we're going to talk quickly about nitrogen and reduction, and we're also going to touch on a wee bit of maybe about wine cellar footwear.
No, we're not.
But you've got a nice set of gumboots.
They are pretty flash, nice and warm and snuggly.
Okay.
Good for this time of year.
I might pick some up later on. So let's talk a wee bit about viticulture and what the issues are. But Tim, just briefly, reduction in the grapes, what is the key issue from a winemaking? So what should we be looking for in the vineyard?
I guess there's a multi-level sort of thing, but it really all starts out in the vineyard to a certain degree, and that's the level of nitrogen that the fruit actually contains, and the yeast use that nitrogen as food during fermentation. So if there's a shortage of that food in the grapes to begin with, then we can run into some issues further down the track.
All right, well, let's talk to Siobhan about that. If it's nitrogen, where does the nitrogen come from?
Ammonium, it can be in many forms, and for a very short time it's plant available. It's not, there's not elemental nitrogen just lying around in the soil that's easily available. If you think back to probably when you were 13, 14 and you go through the nitrogen cycle, a lot of elemental nitrogen is just sitting in the atmosphere, the air we breathe. The vines can't actually use it, or plants can't use it. It's not plant available, that's the term.
Yep.
So it has to go through a cycle where it breaks down into different formats or forms that the plant can actually use. And interestingly, for an element to be taken up by a plant, it actually has to be dissolved in water. So, you know, plants are out there, or vines are out there, and they're actually drinking a broth or a weak soup of nutrients, and mm-hmm. that's how they take it up, and that's how they use it from there. Essentially, what vines do when they photosynthesize is they make sugar, which is made up of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen.
Yep.
But they also do make protein, and the difference there is that, you know, sugars or starches are carbon, hydrogen, oxygen. Proteins are carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen.
Oh, okay.
Juice is required to have a basic level of nitrogen there. Yeast that converts the sugar into alcohol needs to replicate itself, and the yeast coats are made of nitrogen, or protein, sorry. It's a working office, you can tell.
Yeah, it is. The reason I'm interested is because in the UK we're still running some 08 Sauvignon Blancs, and some of the wines which, you know, won awards earlier on, you know, a year or so ago,
yeah.
are starting to become quite reductive.
Yeah.
You know, very sort of
pongy,
yeah. And it's not necessarily all the Sauvignon Blancs that are doing it.
Just some.
And it's also mainly Sauvignon Blanc, I've noticed. I haven't seen it in Riesling or any of the other grape varieties either.
True.
When you were growing the grapes in 08, was there anything you noticed?
Yes, what we are finding is summers, and particularly mid to late summer and autumn, where the natural rainfall is actually quite low. If we have a dry midsummer to autumn, what can happen over time is that the vines become increasingly reliant on the wetted strip of the irrigation, the little pipe that runs underneath them.
I saw that on the way in. There's a bit of water down there.
Exactly. We have to irrigate to have a consistent crop every year, because we're in deficit in Marlborough from about November often through to March, April.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to supplement the vines, because a lot of our vines on the valley floor, they sit in soil that's really free draining. It doesn't hold a lot. So we have to assist them along with regular little waterings. And that wetted strip directly underneath the vines, that can actually get leached out of available nitrogen, because, as I said before, it has to go through its cycle to become released and become plant available. So the soil is doing its thing as much as possible. It's releasing as much as possible. But a great big vine becomes increasingly reliant on that little wetted strip. And it's like, you know, trying to give a cup of tea to 20 people on one tea bag.
Yeah.
It gets worked out. And what can happen if you're not onto it is that at the end of the season, your juice will come in and it will actually be quite depleted of available nitrogen. So you have to be quite vigilant, and you have to track it every year to see whether your levels are going up or down in your juice.
Have you ever thought, like, I understand legumes are nitrogen fixing.
That's right.
So have you, do people
yes,
run
they
legumes?
Do. Yep. And between the rows, in the middle of the rows, people will plant cover crops.
Yep.
Because legumes what they do is they grab that plant unavailable atmospheric nitrogen, and they convert it into plant available forms. However, it's a good supplement. You still need a natural rainfall for the nitrogen in that middle row area for the roots of the vines to get out there to use it.
Yeah.
It's still, you know, it can be a meter and a half away.
Mm-hmm.
And the plants, you know, have to get there via a natural rainfall. And also it only builds up the levels very slowly. So you have to make sure that you're always keeping your vines within balance and not letting them get too depleted. So you have to, you basically have to measure and be quite vigilant. And you can use all those kind of tools.
What about partial
root zone
drying and all that sort of stuff? Is there things that you can do to encourage the vine to maybe get the nutrients from different parts of the root ball?
Yes and no. Sometimes you hear people say, oh, we don't do this because we want to force the roots down in. And,
I know.
Sometimes people can really anthropomorphize plants.
Yeah.
They will do what's easiest.
Yeah.
Roots, you know, for them to go right down deep into soil and at great depths in soil, it actually requires a whole lot of hydraulic force for them to do, and they'll just go where it's easiest. And for us in our climate here in Marlborough, we have 2 inches or 50 millimetres a month, roughly every month. We don't have a winter rainfall, or in a dry summer we have, you know, 50 mils every month. And so we are getting these occasional bursts of natural rainfall, and you know, vines know this, and they will hang around. And within minutes of the topsoil being wet, they can send out these microscopic, very fine roots that actually make the most of it. And up on the root surface is where all the highly weathered soil, and when soil is weathered, it breaks down into tiny little bits.
Yeah.
And when those tiny little bits get wet, they turn into a broth, which is of use to the vine. So roots will go where it's easy money. You know, they just want to get the job done.
And do you fertilize it all? Maybe you can put nitrogen in the water?
Yes, you can. You can fertigate, which is, you know, you can make your little soup and you can add the soup. You have to be quite careful on budgeting the amounts and how and when you put it in and how you put it. You don't want to
burn them off.
Exactly. Nitrogen, too little and too much, it can hurt you either way. So you don't want to sort of burn them off with too high a dose.
What do you see if there's too little nitrogen in the? Can you see it?
Yeah, you see little leaves and you see yellow leaves.
Little
now
yellow.
Each variety has a different shade of green. Chardonnay and Pinot Noir can sometimes be quite a yellow green.
Yeah.
Sauvignon can be what I would call a blue green when it's healthy. So they will have their different shade of green, but basically you're looking for a fully expanded, a large, deep green working leaf. I call it a working leaf because it's a net producer of sugar.
Yeah.
The leaf diameter will get smaller, they will get yellower.
And what about if they've got too much nitrogen?
You will have really big leaves, you'll have very large internodes, you will have very thick canes.
Any burning at the tips of the leaves or anything?
No,
like that?
Not with too much. Oh, if you actually, you know, go and apply too much nitrogen in whatever form, yeah, you will burn it off. It will look like a scald.
Okay. All right, then, Siobhan, I think we'll have a chat to Tim now about the winemaking process of nitrogen. So we've got the grapes, we've got some nitrogen in there, and they come into the cellar ready for you to do your stuff.
Yes.
And what happens? You know, do you measure it, or how do you? What do you do?
Yep, absolutely. So after receival of the fruit and the pressing operation, we'll take a sample of the juice from that particular vineyard block, and we will get one of our lab people to run an analysis and measure the amount of nitrogen that's available to yeast during fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually called YAN, Y-A-N, or yeast assimilable nitrogen.
Yep.
And what we want to see is a nice healthy level of that in the juice, because that ultimately, in really basic terms, means that we're going to have a nice, easily managed, healthy fermentation that remains really clean and it doesn't produce a lot of off aromas or reductive flavors, particularly hydrogen sulfide, which we don't want to see a lot of at all.
So if you've gotten not enough nitrogen, you get a hydrogen sulfide. Is that just the chemistry that goes on with yeast gobbling it up in a nitrogen?
Exactly. So if it's a really poor juice in terms of its nitrogen levels, the yeast are going to get in there, start multiplying. At the beginning of a ferment, it's a bit like a big yeast party. They're all having a good time. There's lots of sugar and nutrients, but they'll quickly eat all of those nutrients up, those nutrients being nitrogen mainly. And when they run out of that, they start to get really stressed. And as part of their biochemistry, I guess you could say, they will revert to making hydrogen sulfide in an attempt to re-uptake that hydrogen sulfide and then try and turn that into a source of nitrogen via another biochemical pathway. That's all pretty complex chemistry going on, or biochemistry. But ultimately, if you've got low nitrogen content in your juice, you can almost be assured that you're going to have issues with reduction.
Is there any particular grape varieties that are more susceptible? Because I've noticed Savvy seems to be the one that I really notice from the 08s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say that there's any varieties in particular that are more prone to having lower nitrogen levels than others. I guess it may be related back to how vigorous the plant is. Sauvignon's quite vigorous. It likes to sort of grow a lot of sticks and leaves during the growing season and ripening season. So that's probably putting a bit of a load on the vine as far as its use of nitrogen. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, that could possibly relate to lower nitrogen levels in the juice.
Do they get nitrogen from skin contact? For example, is there nitrogen in the skin? So when you're extracting tannins and colour, you get nitrogen?
Yep, there's lots of goodies in skins for yeast. There's a whole lot of different types of goodies, not only just nitrogen, but ultimately there's a reasonably even spread of nitrogen in the juice and also the skin. So, but skin contacting will increase some of the levels of nutrients and other complex goodies for the yeast to use. But then that's also a compromise stylistically, because as you mentioned, you'll get more tannin pickup and a different flavour profile. So that's winemaking for you. There's lots of compromises. You do one thing and you think that you've solved something or other, and then you've actually got another problem in another area. So
yeah. You've got your juice in, you check your yang. Mm-hmm. Yin and yang sort of thing,
isn't it?
You check your yang and you find that, I haven't got enough nitrogen. So what do you do? Do you just pour in a bit of ammonia and away you go?
No. Kind of, but not really. There's a couple of options, and one of them is to add something called DAP, which is used in many, many different countries around the world. And that is a source of nitrogen or ammonium for the yeast, and it looks a bit like a white granulated salt. And you mix that up in water and add, we're talking pretty small quantities here, add that to the fermentation. And that's a really readily available source of food for yeast. It's almost like junk food for yeast. Then the other option is to get a complex yeast food, which is derived from yeast themselves. It's a yeast extract.
Yep.
And that has a lot of really complex amino acids and proteins in there. And that's good. It takes them a while to eat that up, and it's like a long-lasting food. In a sense, it's a bit like the vegetables of the nitrogen world as far as additives go. So what we've found is a balanced approach between those two methods has given us the best results with keeping our ferments clean.
Yeah. Do you hold back yeast from the previous season, for example? You could use that yourself to reintroduce into if you find your yans out of balance.
No, that's a pretty complex job making yeast extract, best left to the experts. So no, we don't do that.
Okay. So you get your wine, you find that it's got a bit of low nitrogen, you adjust it up.
Yep.
You give it some fast food and maybe some broccoli or something.
That's it. Like hamburgers and vegetables at the same time.
Hamburgers and vegetables. And it comes through. But if you do get some of that hydrogen sulfate, is it hydrogen sulfate or hydrogen sulfide?
Sulfide.
I've heard people just copper the wine or they can strip it out.
Yep.
And what's that process going on there?
Okay, so that will bind the hydrogen sulfide and it will form an insoluble material and then fall to the bottom of the tank. So essentially remove all of that hydrogen sulfide that's in the wine. Definitely the best thing to be doing is to manage your ferments such that you don't have hydrogen sulfide there in the first place.
Well, what's the problem with just stripping it out later on?
Well, certainly I believe the less that you do to a wine, the better that it is. The more that you poke and prod and add things and tweak it up here and there, like I said before, there's always compromises to what you're doing. You may be fixing one problem, but then also doing damage to other important flavour compounds, and especially so in Sauvignon Blanc. All of the important flavour and aroma compounds in Sauvignon are actually sulfur-based. So if you're adding copper to remove hydrogen sulfide, which is sulfur-based, it will also start pulling out some of the good stuff too.
There's some methoxyprazine.
These ones are called volatile thiols. There's also another family of compounds in Sauvignon called methoxypyrazines, which is responsible for the more herbal and grassy flavors. Whereas volatile thiols, the sulfur-based group of compounds that are important in Savvy, are responsible for flavors like passion fruit, grapefruit. Sometimes people talk about a boxwood character, blackcurrant, those kind of aromas. Then in really, really high concentrations, they'll actually start to smell a bit like cat's pee or a sweaty armpit, which is not necessarily a nice thing, but some of that in your overall blend can be useful. But definitely the less copper you need to be adding to your wine to clean up sulfides, the better it is in terms of protecting that important group of compounds.
Okay. The last thing I'll just touch on is one of the wines that I'm noticing, the 08 Savvies, that is quite reductive now. Mm-hmm. And these are quite old wines by, you know, drink them young sort of approach. But one of the wines was a gold medal winner at the IWC.
Yep.
You know, came in, won lots of medals, tasted brilliantly. I loved it. Mm-hmm. And then now, year and a half, coming up to 2 years later, well, over 2 years probably almost now, it's starting to go quite reductive.
Yep.
Is that a screw cap issue or was it a problem with the winemaking initially?
Ultimately, it's probably an issue with the winemaking more so than the closure, but there's kind of a linkage there and I can explain that. First off, the winemaking side, those ferments have probably been quite dirty at some stage. And
dirty
as in lots of hydrogen sulfide and other bad sulfur compounds that you don't want. And when you have those compounds, especially hydrogen sulfide, there's a real danger in exposing the young wine to a lot of oxygen or air, mm-hmm. because that will turn the hydrogen sulfide into a more complex form of smelly stuff. If you like.
Well, like your garlics and your...
Exactly. Things called disulfides. And they actually aren't as smelly as hydrogen sulfide. So in effect, you can be oxidizing all of your hydrogen sulfide and turning it into disulfides. Mm-hmm. And then the smell seems to go away because they have a higher sensory threshold than hydrogen sulfide does. But they're still there. And that reaction is actually reversible over time. So if you put that into a bottle that has a good closure that doesn't let a lot of oxygen in, that reaction will actually reverse and the disulfides essentially snap in half and then turn into something else which is really smelly called a mercaptan.
Yep.
And then suddenly you've put a clean wine into bottle and then after a number of years or even sometimes months, depending on how bad the problem is, you'll suddenly have a really stinky wine. And that, I would say, is what's going on there. And the linkage between the screw cap and that whole area of chemistry is that the screw cap with a Stelvin liner in it is a really effective barrier against oxygen, which is fantastic for looking after young, aromatic, fresh wines.
Yep.
And if you look at the numbers, they actually perform the same as a really good cork.
Yep.
Corks are natural products, so there's lots of variation within a batch of cork, and some of those cork closures will perform the same way as a Stelvin. So I don't think you can necessarily blame the Stelvin for that.
Okay. It was the wine in the first place, so...
Yep, but a function of the closure that it's under, which is uniform in terms of its oxygen permeation, tends to make this problem more apparent over time because that really anaerobic or oxygen-free environment will then cause that reaction to shift back and then you wind up with a lot of smelly stuff. Does that make
sense? Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. That's exactly brilliant.
It's quite an interesting area and there's a lot of misunderstanding between screw caps and cork and why is screw cap better than cork or is cork better than screw cap? And I don't think there's any such thing as a perfect wine bottle closure.
Mm.
Like we talked about earlier, winemaking's all about a series of compromises. So it's a matter of balancing up what works best for your wines and looking at the benefits, like the pros and cons, and does that fit with what we're doing? But I mean, certainly to talk to the screw cap debate, for our wines, it makes a lot of sense. We want to protect those delicate aromas and have the wines landing fresh. But Siobhan was talking earlier about the work that we can do in the vineyard to make sure we don't have problems with low nitrogen level juices entering the winery.
Yep.
So those fermentations are easier to manage as a function of having higher levels of nitrogen. And then we have cleaner fermentations, then less problems with having to go back and do a whole lot of remedial winemaking work to correct issues that have happened
yep.
during the ferment. And then ultimately, we can put our wines to bottle under a screw cap and be quite confident that they're not going to get all smelly and reductive over time. And I think if you look at Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc, it's made in quite of a like a tight fashion. It's nice and clean, especially when it's first released. It's quite tightly coiled, and it's a Sauvignon that I believe does age quite well. I had a 96 with Lynn Sheriff, Master of Wine, a while ago, and that was a beautiful wine. Delicious wine, still very alive, very vibrant, fantastic. I think to drink Marlborough Sauvignon when it's made in that very fresh tank fermented style as an older wine is a somewhat academic exercise, but the wines, I think it shows the pedigree of the wines, and I think not all Marlborough Sauvignons age as well as each other.
What about storage conditions? If it's too hot or anything like that, will that encourage any sulfur nose?
Not so much. It'll just rapidly accelerate the evolution of the wine.
So it'll speed up going that way?
Yes, yeah, or just speed up looking tired and dull and looking...
All right then, Tim and Siobhan, thank you very much.